Welcome to this sermon on John chapter 9, the healing of the man born blind. In our series through the Gospel of John, we are really going to pick up speed this morning, going to do a whole chapter in one sermon. The previous chapter, John 8, took us six sermons, and the one before that took four. This chapter is covered in one because it's one story, complete in itself. Of course, it has its place in the flow of John's narrative, but it can almost stand on its own, closes its own loop. It's a story simple in action, but profoundly rich, dripping with implications. We'll begin by listening to John chapter 9, then we'll survey it to be sure the action is in focus, then we'll pursue two lines of application. Two ways this story should affect our stories. So, we begin with the story itself. This is John chapter 9 from the Word of Promise audio Bible.
Now as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth, and his disciples asked him,
Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?
Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world.
When he had said these things, he spat on the ground and made clay with the saliva. And he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay.
Go, wash in the pool of Siloam.
Which is translated, sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. Therefore the neighbors and those who previously had seen that he was blind said,
Is not this he who sat and begged?
This is he.
Others said,
He is like him.
I am he.
How were your eyes opened?
A man called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, Go to the pool of Siloam and wash. So I went and washed and I received sight.
Where is he?
I do not know.
They brought him who formerly was blind to the Pharisees. Now it was a Sabbath when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. Then the Pharisees also asked him again how he had received his sight.
He put clay on my eyes, and I washed, and I see.
This man is not from God, because he does not keep the Sabbath.
How can a man who is a sinner do such signs?
And there was a division among them. They said to the blind man again,
What do you say about him, because he opened your eyes?
He is a prophet.
But the Jews did not believe concerning him. That he had been blind and received his sight, until they called the parents of him who had received his sight, and he asked them, saying,
Is this your son, who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?
We know that this is our son, and that he was born blind, but by what means he now sees, we do not know, or who opened his eyes. We do not know. He is of age. Ask him. He will speak for himself.
His parents said these things because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had agreed already that if anyone confessed that he was Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue. Therefore his parents said, He is of age, ask him. So they again called the man who was blind.
Give God the glory. We know that this man is a sinner.
Whether he is a sinner or not, I do not know. One thing I know, that though I was blind, now I see.
What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?
I told you already, and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?
Then they reviled him.
You are his disciple, but we are Moses' disciples. We know that God spoke to Moses. As for this fellow, we do not know where he is from.
Why? This is a marvelous thing that you do not know where he is from. Yet he has opened my eyes. Now, we know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, he hears him. Since the world began, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who was born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing.
You were completely born in sins, and are you teaching us?
And they cast him out. Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and when he had found him, he said to him,
"Do you believe in the Son of God?"
"Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?"
"You have both seen him, and it is he who is talking with you."
"Lord, I believe."
And he worshipped him.
"For judgment I have come into this world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may be made blind."
Then some of the Pharisees who were with him heard these words.
"Are we blind also?"
"If you were blind, you would have no sin. But now you say, we see. Therefore, your sin remains."
Quick review. Since John gives no indication of the passage of time, we assume continuity. We're still shortly after the Feast of Tabernacles, which means practically this is yet another round in the conflict between Jesus and the authorities. Chapter 8 closed with them trying to stone him to death. So one might reasonably ask, what's left to happen? Isn't it settled? Well, not quite. The attempted stoning at the end of John 8 was a small-scale, spontaneous response to Jesus' declaration, "Before Abraham was, I am." In John 9, we see it's gone up a notch. There has been an official decision. The man born blind's parents were hesitant to say anything because, verse 22, the Jews had agreed already that if anyone confessed that he was Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue. That has been decided and published. That is, it is known by the people. So the authorities' resistance is deepening and hardening. Meanwhile, Jesus and the disciples are just strolling through the city when they come upon a man born blind, which leads the disciples to ask a thoughtful question. "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus replies, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him." The theme of responsibility, who's responsible for what, is one we'll be pursuing in application. But in overview, Jesus just spits on the ground and gets to work, makes clay or mud, applies it to the man's eyes, and tells him to go and wash in the pool of Siloam, which he does and comes back healed. He can see. It is important to note the man was born blind. He is not somebody who had sight and then lost it through some accident or misfortune. Any number of afflictions can cause the loss of sight, a not uncommon condition in the ancient world. But this man never had sight. He was born blind. As he himself will say, verse 32, "Since the world began, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who was born blind." Understandably, this creates a stir. People are going, "Is that him?" "Nah, just looks like him." He goes, "It's me, it's me." They ask, "What happened?" He tells them. Like so many of Jesus' miracles, this was performed on the Sabbath and therefore stirred up the ire of the Pharisees, who convene an ad hoc tribunal to investigate the healing. And in a way, that tells you everything you need to know, that it had to be investigated. Why couldn't it just be celebrated? Man born blind gets his sight? Hooray! Well, it had to be investigated because Jesus had yet again broken the Sabbath. The man is brought before them and they ask him what happened. For all the wonder of the story, the action is really simple. As he puts it, verse 15, "He put clay on my eyes and I washed and I see. Therefore, some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God because he does not keep a Sabbath. Others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? And there was a division among them. Verse 16 encapsulates the conflict. We talked about this in the sermon back on the start of chapter 7, where it says, verse 5, even his brothers did not believe in him. Talked about the set of expectations, the script they had, and how Jesus kept going off the script, compelling them to choose between him and their script. Same thing here. Some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God because he is off script. That is, because he did not keep the Sabbath in their way. Others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs, raising the possibility the script might be flawed? That's what the division was about. Were they going to stick with their script and reject Jesus, or accept Jesus and, horror of horrors, abandon or at least amend their script? You can be pardoned for not understanding what they're upset about. Probably have a general idea the Sabbath was a special day set apart to God, but may have trouble seeing how Jesus broke it. It wasn't that he spat on the ground. There's an old stereotype about getting arrested for spitting on the sidewalk. That's not the problem here. It wasn't that he spat. It's that he made clay or mud with the saliva. That required work, and that was the problem. Exodus 20:10, the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work. Jesus, in the process of healing the man born blind, had mixed his saliva with some dirt and applied it as a poultice to the man's eyes. That teaspoon's worth of clay or mud, that's the issue. Making it required work. On the Sabbath, you shall do no work. And the Pharisees would like to know what part of no Jesus doesn't understand. Clearly, he could not be from God because he did not keep the Sabbath. Yet again, you can be pardoned for having a hard time believing that's really the issue. That little bit of kneading to make the mud, that's what this is all about? Alas, 'tis true, 'tis true. The authorities had, shall we say, lost perspective on a number of matters. One of the more obvious ones being the Sabbath, which is why Jesus routinely violated not God's command about the Sabbath, but their multi-volume encyclopedia of regulations about the Sabbath. He was tearing through that like Godzilla through Tokyo, repeatedly compelling them to choose between their rule book and him. Some said he can't be from God because he made a mud pie on the Sabbath, and as it says in Volume 3, Chapter 17, Section 5, Paragraph 2, Line 9, that's a sin. Others noticed something else, that he had opened the eyes of a man born blind. And it gave them pause. It made them wonder, how could a sinner do that? They had to choose between their rule book and Jesus, or maybe not. Maybe there was a way out of this troubling dilemma. Maybe that guy wasn't really born blind. If he had been sighted and then lost his sight, and then regained it again, that would be much less miraculous than healing somebody born blind. That would enable them to dismiss Jesus as a quack healer who got lucky and leave their rule book and their status and their pride completely intact. So, they roust out the man's poor parents who were quietly enjoying the Sabbath somewhere and suddenly find themselves the key witnesses at an inquisition. Through no choice of their own, they are thrust onto center stage of the Jesus debate, and they know the answer the interrogators would like to hear. but they meekly speak the truth while maintaining as low a profile as possible. We know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but how and who, you're going to have to check with him. So they drag the guy back up and with lawyerly logic change the question. It's no longer how were you healed or were you born blind, but what is your theology of Sabbath observance? Verse 24, give God the glory. We know that this man is a sinner. Give God the glory is a charge to speak the truth, sort of an imposed oath. They know Jesus is a sinner because he's off their script. He broke their rules. Wouldn't it have been nice if the Pharisees could just have lightened up? Just relax. Have a little laugh at themselves. Go, well, boy, we sure learned something today, didn't we? It would have been oh so nice. But it's not going to happen. That's not what they're about. They are dead serious. They've got a man born blind, miraculously healed, that very day, standing in front of them, and they can't see past the mud pie Jesus made. They are going to damn themselves. They are going to go to hell over that mud pie. They are rejecting Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the light of the world, because he spat on the ground and made clay with his saliva on the Sabbath. Obviously, the mud pie is just an accident of circumstance, the thing it happened to be about. What's really at stake is their way of life, everything they are invested in. You know the line about finally clawing your way to the top of the ladder, only to discover it's leaning against the wrong wall? That's what they are in danger of. And the possibility that they may be wrong is too horrible to conceive. They are the experts, the spiritual elite. The poor schmuck they're interrogating is a nobody. From their exalted religious platform, they thunder down to him, give God the glory. We know this man is a sinner. He replies, whether he is a sinner or not, I do not know. One thing I know, that though I was blind, now I see. We'll be talking about that in application. But summing up the overview, the harder the Pharisees try, the stupider they look. This apparently dawns on them, so they bring it to a conclusion simply by throwing the guy out. Jesus finds him and asks, do you believe in the Son of God? He answers, who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him? Jesus says, you have both seen him, and it is he who is talking to you. He says, Lord, I believe. And he worships him. Jesus says, for judgment I have come into this world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may be made blind. Some Pharisees overhear and ask, are we blind also? Jesus replies, if you were blind, you would have no sin. But now you say, we see, therefore your sin remains. Thus the story of the healing of the man born blind. We'll pursue two tracks by way of application, one about responsibility and the other about obstinacy. So let's talk responsibility. Who's responsible for what? The story begins with a question about responsibility. Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? An honest and reasonable question addressing that particular instance of the problem of evil. They are trying to make moral sense of the universe. In this case, what's the moral cause, the reason he was born blind? Jesus replies, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. A fascinating answer on its own merits, But if that was all that was said about responsibility in this passage, we wouldn't be pursuing it in application. But that's just the start. The matter of responsibility permeates this passage and concludes it. Take a look at the end. Jesus says, "For judgment I have come into this world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may be made blind." The Pharisees ask, "Are we blind also? If you were blind, you would have no sin. But now you say, 'We see,' therefore your sin remains." Juxtaposing physical and spiritual sight, Jesus begins by saying, "That man was not responsible for his physical blindness," and concludes by saying, "The Pharisees are responsible for their spiritual blindness." Of course, every story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Jesus talks about responsibility at the beginning and at the end. Everybody else is talking about it in the middle. The inquest hinges on the cause of the blind man's healing. How could a sinner, someone who violated the Sabbath, perform such a miracle? Take a step back. It's all about cause and effect. To begin with, there's an effect. A man was born blind. What was the cause? His sin or his parents? Answer, neither. In conclusion, there's an effect. The Pharisees are spiritually blind. What is the cause? Their pride. They insist they see. In the middle, the effect is that the man born physically blind can now see. What was the cause of that? How did that come about? The cause appears to have been Jesus, but that will not compute for the Pharisees. They cannot admit the possibility, for it would imply that their rule book, and by extension they themselves, were flawed. And there was, in their minds, no way that could be true. In that sense, they're like the Iraqi information minister during the 2003 invasion. If you were around for that, I'm sure you remember him. Came to be known as Baghdad Bob. Made fantastic announcements about the defeat of U.S. troops. The Iraqis had him on the run. They were surrendering, committing suicide, blah, blah, blah. Near the end, broadcasting from Baghdad, insisting U.S. forces had not entered the city, as he was speaking, you could hear the combat in the streets around him. Now and then, he'd visibly flinch from an explosion, but none of it was happening, not according to him. That was his story, and he stuck with it as the facade crumbled around him. With a similar determination to deny what was happening right in front of their eyes, the Pharisees had their story, and they were sticking with it. So entrenched was their pride, so unshakable their conviction they were right, they knowingly, with eyes wide open, rejected the man, the miracle, and by extension Jesus. They had to. Accepting any part of it would involve admitting an error on their part, and that was so unthinkable, so impossible for them. They denied one of the greatest miracles the world had ever seen, which occurred right in front of them, which their investigation confirmed. None of that mattered. They refused to see it. Those who could see chose to be blind. Well, the problem of evil as a whole is, I'm sorry to say, a bit much for us to tackle this morning. As for why this particular man was born blind, neither his nor his parents' sin is the cause. We have the Savior's word for it on that. But that only tells us about his situation. It doesn't tell us about any other situation. like a guy who was healed in the last Sabbath-breaking miracle recorded in John. That was back in chapter 5. Pool of Bethesda, man infirm 38 years. Jesus said, take up your bed and walk. Immediately he was made well, took up his bed and walked. The Sabbath violation in that instance was carrying the bed. Anyway, verse 14, afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, see, you have been made well. Sin no more, lest a worse thing come upon you. The plain reading of that is, in some way, he was responsible for his infirmity. So who's responsible for what? Man born blind was not responsible for being born blind, but apparently the man infirm 38 years was responsible for his infirmity. I guess. I don't really know. I don't know how responsible you are for your circumstances. You may be living the life you deserve. Maybe it's better than you deserve. Maybe it's worse. God knows. I don't. Matters a tad above my pay grade and yours. Tell you what I do know. I know the man born blind and the man infirm 38 years and the Pharisees and you and I know that we're all responsible for how we respond to Jesus. I know that. Jesus showed himself to the man born blind and he believed in him. Jesus showed himself to the Pharisees and they did not. And whatever their earthly circumstances, both the man born blind and the Pharisees, the people we're reading about in the story, they exist right now in eternity. And they are living right now eternally with exactly what they deserve based on their response to Jesus. We can spend a lot of time talking about the problem of evil and cause and effect and what we deserve, and I spend more time thinking about that than most, but at the end of the day, the only thing that matters is how you respond to Jesus. That is what you are entirely and solely responsible for. Amen. So let us turn to obstinacy. And I'm aware the term has a negative connotation, sort of a highfalutin word for stubbornness. Yet I place it before you as a desirable characteristic, a quality to which you should aspire. We'll take a look at it in the story, then I'll explain why I've labeled it obstinance. Since our story, The Healing of the Man Born Blind, John 9, has existed all your life, and because it's always read the way it reads, it can be difficult to hear it with fresh ears, to hear it anew. If you were raised a Christian, you've heard the story maybe 10 times, maybe 100. But you've heard it enough to know that one. It's worn grooves, or should we call them ruts, in your mind. You're familiar enough with it to listen to it without hearing it. You know how it goes. Same old thing. I want to call your attention to one aspect of it. And that is the yawning chasm between the status of the Pharisees and the status of the man born blind. Their social position, their earthly significance. It's not just many against one. The group, the Pharisaic tribunal, had the authority. They were the establishment, the authorized, recognized, lionized experts. As Jesus put it, Matthew 23:2, they sat in Moses' seat. And the man born blind was a schmuck, an absolute nobody. He's not listed in who's who. He's barely even listed in who. Thank you. He's got no money. No education, no status, does not even have a job. He has been a beggar his entire life until right now, today, when he happens to have been given sight, miraculously and controversially, he can see. That is the only thing he can do, see. But it's more than enough for him. This nobody, this man born blind, touched by Jesus, now granted sight, he is going to stand toe to toe with the educated, authorized experts, and he is going to take them to school. With the simplest, clearest reasoning, he will expose them as fools. His reward will be to be cast out, banished. But he'll end up with more joy than they could possibly imagine. Here again is John 9, 24 through 34. So again they called the man who was blind and said to him, "Give God the glory, we know that this man is a sinner." He answered and said, "Whether he is a sinner or not, I do not know. One thing I know, though I was blind, now I see." Then they said to him again, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered them, "I told you already, and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?" Then they reviled him and said, "You are his disciple, but we are Moses' disciples. We know God spoke to Moses. As for this fellow, we do not know where he is from." Man answered and said, "Why, this is a marvelous thing, that you do not know where he is from, yet he opened my eyes. Now we know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, he hears him. Since the world began, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who was born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." They answered and said to him, "You are completely born in sins, and are you teaching us?" And they cast him out. Earlier I said the inquest hinged on the cause of the blind man's healing. How could a sinner perform such a miracle? Our schmuck doesn't even know the answer to that. He only knows one thing, verse 25. "Whether he is a sinner or not, I do not know. One thing I know, that though I was blind, now I see." That single fact, which for him was not a bit of information, but the profoundest personal experience, that one thing is what he stood on. The one against the many, the dregs against the cream, the nobody against the everybody. He only knew one thing, the truth. And that enabled him to stand against all the social, all the political, all the religious pressure they could bring. His reward was to be condemned and exiled. As the Master said, "Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you. Say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice, be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven." His unshakable personal knowledge of Jesus' touch in his life enabled him to stand against everyone and everything else. He stood absolutely alone against the world because he knew one thing. You can call him courageous, fearless, valiant, resolute, tenacious. The reason I've called it obstinance is that's how it appears to the attackers. That's what it looks like to them. There is a well-known historical document from the early 2nd century. It's written from a Roman governor from a province in Turkey to the emperor asking advice about the Christian problem. The governor's name was Pliny the Younger, and the emperor at the time was Trajan. Just Google Pliny, P-L-I-N-Y, and Trajan, T-R-A-J-A-N. It'll pop right up. It's just about a page in length. It is well worth reading for devotional as well as historical reasons. From it, I cite the paragraph where Pliny explains his current procedures while he's awaiting the emperor's instruction. Quote, The method I have observed toward those who have been denounced to me as Christians is this. I interrogated them whether they were Christians. If they confessed it, I repeated the question twice again, adding the threat of capital punishment. If they still persevered, I ordered them to be executed. For whatever the nature of their creed might be, I had no doubt that such insubordination and inflexible obstinacy deserved to be punished. I'm aware I'm just dropping a historical quote on you without filling in the background, but the statement, whatever the nature of their creed might be, I had no doubt that such insubordination and inflexible obstinacy deserved to be punished. I think that stands on its own. You understand what he is saying is it doesn't matter what they believe, whether it's good or bad, right or wrong. The simple fact that they will not renounce Jesus Christ deserves to be punished. He is putting people to death just because they won't renounce Christ. And that makes sense to him. The point I'm trying to make is that the world, in this instance the Roman government, at John 9 it's the Jewish religious establishment, around us it's the social political mindset, the world, that thing, hates commitment to Christ just because. It just does. Simply because it's above and beyond the world. And it just hates that. And in the world's mind, that in and of itself deserves to be punished. Whatever the nature of their creed might be, there is no doubt that such insubordination and inflexible obstinacy deserves to be punished. People he was putting to death were not criminals. They were good citizens. They weren't being put to death for anything they had done. They were being put to death because they would not deny Jesus. The practical point I am trying to make here is that you had better know the touch of Jesus in your life. As our brother in John 9 put it, whether he is a sinner or not, I do not know. He did not have his Christology worked out. There's a little ambiguity and room for improvement there. One thing he knew, that though he had been blind, now he saw. We had better know that one thing. You better know he's your shepherd and you're his sheep. You'd better know he's the vine and you're the branch. You'd better see his light that shines in the darkness. The knowledge of that one thing will make you, in the eyes of heaven, courageous, fearless, valiant. And in the eyes of the world, inflexibly obstinate. Lord, you are great and beautiful and wonderful. We look at one thing you did, open the eyes of a man born blind. And Lord, we want to rejoice. We want to celebrate. We'll investigate and we'll celebrate. And we want to stand with our brother with that kind of conviction and confidence. Lord, would you grant for us in the ways that we need it the knowledge of your touch in our life. And may we stand with joy and pride and delight and inflexible obstinacy in opposition to the world. Jesus, for your glory. Amen.